This is Blessed Trails with Belinda Gale on Equestrian Legacy Radio, heard around the world online at equestrianlegacy.net.
I am so glad our trails have crossed. Oh, the joy you bring to me. And as I look upon each face, such kindness there I see. I wish for you the love of God, a love that never fails. And as we travel life's long path, I wish you blessed go their separate ways, and life goes rolling on. I hope our trails will cross again before God takes us home. We share the wondrous love of God, a love that never fails. And as we travel life long path, I wish you blessed trails. Yes, as we travel life's long path, I wish you blessed trails. Blessed trails.
Welcome to Blessed Trails. I am your host, Belinda Gale, and our show features interviews with wonderful guests, as well as gospel, inspirational, and patriotic music with a definite Western flair. Famous for his gunfighter ballads, today's guest is legendary in Western music and definitely made his mark on radio and country music, as well as television and even some movies. But before we bring him on, let's listen to his version of Streets of Laredo.
As I walked out in the streets of Laredo, as I walked out in Laredo one day, I spied a young cowboy white linen, wrapped up in white linen, as cold as the clay. Beat the drum slowly, play the fife slowly, play the dead march as you carry me along. Take me to the green valley, there lay the sod o'er me, for I'm a young cowboy, and I know I've done wrong. Get 16 gamblers to carry my coffin, get 6 pretty maidens to bear up my pall. Put bunches of roses all over my coffin, roses to deaden the sigh as it falls. Play slowly, play the dead march as you carry me along. Take me to the green valley. valley, there lay the sod o'er me, for I'm a young cowboy, and I know I've done
a voice. Oh my gosh. I first came to know this fine gentleman as the DJ, actually, in Wichita, Kansas, with no idea who he really was. I didn't realize that I was sitting across the mic from a member of the TV Theme Hall of Fame, Country Music Disc Jockey Hall of Fame, Old Time Country Music Hall of Fame, Western Music Association Hall of Fame, Wichita Professional Broadcasters Hall of Fame, Kansas Cowboy Hall of Fame, and Kansas Western Swing Hall of Fame. Oh my gosh. And despite a stellar career in music, radio, silver screen, and television, he is one of the most down-to-earth, kind, and generous people I know. I feel so blessed to be able to call him and his precious wife, Jo, my dear friends. I am proud to welcome to the show, truly the last of the Silver Screen Cowboys, Johnny Western. Welcome,
well, hello,
Johnny.
Dear friend. It's great to talk to you.
This is so fun because I'm used to being on the other side of this situation with you in Kansas. So this is fun. I get to interview you.
Well, this is what goes around comes around, Belinda, because we had a marvelous time 6 or 7 years ago when you were on my show at KFDI Radio there in Wichita, and, you know, we have worked together in some wonderful places through the years as singers also, of course, including Silver Dollar City in beautiful
yes.
Branson, Missouri, and out west in the Santa Clarita Festival and a whole bunch of places in between. I can remember a very special Christmas show that we did in Apple Valley, California for the
yes.
Children's Foundation out there. So I've got some wonderful memories of you and I on the road and doing these shows as well as the radio shows.
We have a lot of history, Johnny. We do. It's so fun. And this is fun because I got to really dig into your past, and we get to talk about that. And you know, I mean, I know a lot about you from when in your career, from when I've met you onward, and some of the back history. But this is, like, so cool. I know I would really love to kind of kick this off, starting talking about your childhood. And it sounds like y'all moved around a lot, and you even lived on Indian reservations. I thought that was incredible. So you want to tell us a little bit about your upbringing?
Well, I was born in Two Harbors, Minnesota, up on the Iron Range, just off the coast of Lake Superior, but I never lived there. My dad, during the Depression, was an officer in the CCCs, the Civilian Conservation Corps. So we actually lived in the North Woods, fairly close to the Canadian border, and close to the Red Lake Indian Reservation. And we were up there for 5 years. The first 5 years of my life were spent up there. And that was what triggered my whole life, because on my fifth birthday, which happened on October the 28th, 1939, see, I'm way ahead of you, kid, but
just a little bit.
They showed a Gene Autry movie on my birthday at the camp. And I took one look at that guy with the silver-mounted saddle and the beautiful horse and the white hat and the guitar singing those songs. And that's when I said immediately, that's what I want to be. I want to be him, or I want to be just like him. Never, never, never dreaming, Belinda, that 16 years later he would put me under contract and take me all over the world with him until he retired from show business.
Wow.
That's the way
wow.
that kind of all happened right there. If there had been no Gene Autry, there never would have been a Johnny Western, believe me.
Isn't that amazing? Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, another really cool story from your childhood that I love was when the whole story around when you got your first guitar.
My dad was in the military during World War One. He was mustered out in France in 1918. And while he was over there, the typical of guys, they were playing poker in the quarters there. And one of the guys had a guitar that he was trying to sell or use it as a backup to play a hand of cards. And it didn't work, and my dad had the winning hand, so he won a guitar. My dad was a wonderful piano player. He could play either by ear or by musical note. And so he didn't know what to do with the guitar, but he took it. He won the winning hand, brought it back from France, and promptly put it in the attic when he got back. And so it stayed up there until I was 12 years old. I kept looking at it every time I'd go up the attic to get something. I'd kind of wrap my little hands around it. This is, of course, when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. Couldn't quite reach around those strings. And then on my 12th birthday, he said, what do you want for your birthday? I said, I want that guitar that's up in the attic. It won't cost you anything. It's just laying up there. He said, okay, if you want that guitar. Then, of course, I had to learn how to play it. And by that time, we lived in Northfield, Minnesota, which is the town that Jesse James and the Younger Brothers got shot to pieces in 1876, trying to take the First National Bank there, one of the most famous stories of the West of all time. So I grew up with that particular thing in my background, and I really wanted to learn to play the guitar. There was one guy in my whole town of 5,000 people that knew three chords on a guitar, and he taught me those three chords, and then I bought one of the little instruction books with the little dots on it to show you where to put your fingers on the neck, and I got into it, Melinda, the place where I played until my mother said my fingers actually bled on the strings because no calluses hadn't built up yet. That's how bad I wanted to play it. But that was the trigger. That was the trigger right there at age 12. So,
my goodness.
Yeah.
That's cool. So now when this show is, you know, we are our gospel show, and so I really would like to kind of dip in a little bit into your upbringing as far as your religious upbringing. Were your family churchgoers? Was that, because I know that you and Joe are both believers. And so
My folks belonged to the Congregational Church in Northfield, Minnesota. My mother sang in the choir. My dad did occasionally, but he was head coach at high school and in charge of the physical education department, so he had a lot of things going on weekends sometimes that prevented him from going to church. But I don't think my mother ever missed a Sunday, and I was confirmed when I was 12 years old in the church, and so I have I've been a believer for a long, long time. Now, as you know from traveling, and you know this better than anybody, you miss an awful lot of Sundays of church going because you're on the road. You're on an airplane, or you're in a car or a van or a bus or a train or an airplane, whatever. You're trying to get to the next dates or trying to get home. So I kind of became, in a fairly early stage, knowing that this was going to happen, I kind of became an Advent type guy of the wonderful, wonderful song, "The Place Where I Worship is the Wide Open Spaces." And I just have always felt like I was blessed to be able to do what I wanted to do since I was 5 years old, and that the good Lord was with me every place I was going, and whether it was on a piece of transportation or whether I was lucky to be home and maybe get a Sunday in church, he was always with me. So there we go, and that's maintained to this day.
Well, you can see it in your life, and I totally get that. You have church with the Lord wherever you are and whoever's with you. So
absolutely.
That's why I loved one of the things about a lot of the events that we've done together, Johnny, is that they have Cowboy Church on Sunday. So
they do.
You know, I don't miss a one. If there's one in the area, I definitely participate in it, and I know you do as well. So it's really, really cool. Well, let's get back to your childhood. I was very intrigued by how you ended up being a radio DJ by the age of 13. So you want to tell us about that?
Well, you know, as I said, I learned to play the guitar when I was 12. And when I was 13, we had a 4-H summer camp over at Faribault, Minnesota, which was 13 miles away. And a guy from KDHL Radio brought his tape recorder over, and he said, we're going to record some of these kids out here at the 4-H summer camp and see what's going on. And somebody told him, said, well, you know, Johnny sings. He's got his guitar here, and he sings. So he said, that'd be good. That'd be a good thing for a teenage kid on the air, you know, at summer camp, and record one song. Well, the song was Ghost Riders in the Sky, which was the first song I ever sang on the radio. And they took the tape back and played it on the air and got some response from people who said, you know, that kid, he sounds a lot older than 13. I guess when my voice had changed when I was 12, I started into this thing where I began to have a 3-octave voice. And, you know, I had emulated somewhat Rex Allen Sr. at that time, who did have a 3-octave voice. But it just kind of fell into place when my voice did change. And about 6 months later, three young guys from Tulsa, Oklahoma, were going to Carleton College in my hometown of Northfield, and they had a little group together called the Cannon River Boys. And they were looking for a fourth member of the group to kind of round it out. They're just doing things at the Kiwanis Club and Rotary Club and little, you know, type things going around the town there, kind of killing some time on the weekends especially. And they asked me to join in. Well, once again, the guy from the radio station came over. We were doing an event. And he said, let me record this thing. So he recorded about 15 minutes, and it was about 2 or 3 minutes left on the end of that tape. I had not sung. I was just playing guitar and kind of doing some harmony. and he said, can that kid put a song on the tape? He said, I remember him from summer camp. So I sang once again, Ghost Riders in the Sky. When they took the tape back to the radio station, to make a long story short, the owners of the radio station thought that the trio was too twangy for that upper Midwest type thing. They were more Southwest and Oklahoma type style musicians, but he liked my voice. The main owner of the radio station liked my voice and said, you know, I think we could do about a 15-minute show once a week with that kid. So I started out actually just singing, doing a 15-minute show, but as luck would have it, that expanded into another 15-minute show, so I was on twice a week and then three times a week, and of course going to school the whole time. And then they came with the idea, said, if you could do the Farm and Home Hour from 12 until 1, we could put you on 5 days a week. Well, being my dad was a coach and in charge of that department at the high school, the PE department, I got a little breather there. I could be back at school by 5 after 1. So I did that for a couple of years, and of course that included playing records. So as a disc jockey then, the first record I ever played was Vaughn Monroe's record of, guess what, Ghost Riders in the Sky. So that had become a permanent part of my life in radio, but that's how it got started. A complete fluke of that radio announcer asking me to do that last couple of minutes on that tape, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Oh, my God. Well, that was your destiny. That was just your destiny. Oh, my goodness. So, and then, now tell me how you actually got to perform with the Sons of the Pioneers, right?
Yeah, they were coming through the territory. Time between my junior and senior year in high school, and they were doing some appearances in the area, and I had them on my radio show at KDHL, and I had my first record out. I had recorded for a small label in Minneapolis and St. Paul called Joco Records, J-O-C-O, which stood for the Johnson Olson Company. But they were distributing the records in 5 states, and they had heard one of my songs called The Violet and the Rose on the radio someplace, and then when I had them on the show, they put two and two together and said, you know, we're going to be working these dates in this area, and you've got a big listening area, why don't you come out and join us on the road for a while? And I thought it was just going to be a few dates. Turned out to be all summer long, and we toured the biggest rodeos in the world that summer of 1952. And it was just an absolutely wonderful time because the Sons of the Pioneers, of course, the greatest Western singing group in the history of the world, and the singers behind me on the record that you just played, the Streets of Laredo. They did my entire Have Gun Will Travel album with me as my backup singers on Columbia Records. So back to that era and all those wonderful guys. Now, at that time, Ken Curtis, who later became world famous as Festus on Gunsmoke, was the lead singer with the Sons of the Pioneers. And then Tommy Doss, who had taken Bob Nolan's place and had that similar voice to Bob Nolan, of course, did a lot of the featured singing on the Pioneers, the great Lloyd Perriman, who did all of their arrangements. And then we had the Farr brothers, Hugh and Carl Farr, who, as you remember, Belinda, were just inducted last year into the Western Music Hall of Fame there in our big doings in Albuquerque as a great brother act. And then the comedian and bass player was Shug Fisher, who later became a great, well, I guess you would call a character actor in movies as well. So I went out on the road with the very best of the best of the Sons of the Pioneers, and it was a marvelous experience. And then years later, they did that album with me, which was terrific.
Oh my gosh, that is just stunning to have those kind of people to be able to actually cut your teeth and get your foundation in performing with those kind of people. Wow.
Well, they were a great inspiration, as you can imagine. And of course, when we finally got to Hollywood in 1962 and recorded the Have Gun Will Travel album there at Columbia Records, to stand in the same room with the greatest Western singers in the world singing backup to me, if you can imagine that, is the biggest thrill I can even think of to this day. It was just really something else.
Oh, gosh, I can imagine you're just floating through the whole recording session. I could just
imagine. We recorded over a three-day period. We did 4 songs a day for 3 days. And then it was just absolutely gorgeous. And, of course, these were the days when you didn't cut tracks and come in and put headphones on. We did it all in the studio with all the great musicians. I had Johnny Bond, whose place I had taken on the Gene Autry Show, playing guitar, along with the great Billy Strange, a couple of guys from the Los Angeles Symphony that were on the show, and, of course, the French horns that were just marvelous for the big thematic things that we needed. So, yeah, it was the greatest experience of my life, and maintain to this day that that album's the best thing I ever did in my whole career.
Oh my goodness! Well, it's an incredible album, and I'd like to listen to one of your songs right now. This is a beautiful song, and all of the songs we're featuring today are off of your album that features more the gunfighter kind of ballads and things. But this is a beautiful song called "Grow High." Is there anything you want to say about this?
The great Stan Jones, who wrote Ghost Riders in the Sky and wrote the theme song from The Searchers, which I also recorded on this album. Mm-hmm. Stan, in this album, I recorded six of his songs. They were two of the greatest Western songwriters in the world. Of course, the great Bob Nolan, who wrote songs like Cool Water and Tumbling Tumbleweeds, and Stan Jones, who wrote the great movie songs that we're talking about. So I was very, very privileged to have a great personal relationship with Stan and loved his music. So that is what we got. The Lilies Grow High was actually written for a movie, a 20th Century Fox, that starred Gregory Peck called The Gunfighter. However, Stan couldn't get together on the money with Daryl F. Zanuck, who ran the studio at that time, so he pulled the song at the last minute, and originally the movie was not a big hit. I think it would have been a bigger hit with this song. But later on, the movie became a kind of a cult favorite and a great Gregory Peck thing. But the song was written, if you listen to the words, you'll see exactly what Stan was writing about with that aging gunfighter.
All righty, the lilies grow high.
Boots and Stetson and six guns and the lilies grow high. They grow for a man with a gunslinging hand who before his time must die. A trail well spattered with lead. They weep for the graves of the many men. They weep for the men now dead. He rides along lonely, no friends but only the lilies growing high. All men seem to fear him, not one will go. And he knows the reason why. His name and fame spread before him like a carpet of death, and he knows one day he'll be slow on the draw, and then for him a lily will grow. A woman may love him, though she knows soon above him the lilies growing high. Then like the lily she'll bow down her poor head and cry. On some boot hill they will lay him, and a headboard will sway in the wind. The lily and six guns and the lilies grow high.
The lilies grow high.
And the lilies grow high.
Wow. I think you're right, Johnny. I think that would add a lot to that movie. I do.
Yes, it would have added a lot to the movie. And the song is so great. It's one of the greatest things. In fact, I talked to Marty Robbins about it a lot. And as you know, Marty Robbins was a great purveyor of great Western music, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, of the modern-day cowboy singers of all of Western music. And he said, my favorite thing that Stan ever wrote was The Lilies Grow High. He said, I wanted to record it, but I was writing so many things on my own and never got around to it. He said, I'm glad you did. And I'm glad I did also.
Oh, well, you did a beautiful job on it. Really,
thanks.
it's wonderful, Johnny. Well, you had several pivotal milestones in your career, but one of them, and I think it because it stays with you yet today, and it's associated with you and all of the shows that I've seen you with that chess piece on your guitar strap and on everything is when you co-wrote the theme song for Paladin. And can you tell us how all that came about?
Well, I was doing movies as an actor for a couple of years. I did a lot of shows. I was in a television series called Boots and Saddles, a cavalry series for NBC. And we were shooting up in Kanab, Utah for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then came back to do interior scenes in Hollywood at the California National Studios at Paramount. And a couple doors away from where we were shooting was Gunsmoke, which I had done a couple of Gunsmokes with Jim Arness and Dennis Weaver as an actor. And then there was a brand new show starting at the end of the line there, the last studio, and I saw Richard Boone pull in with his black Maserati one day when we were doing Boots and Saddles, and I asked one of the other actors, said, "What's Richard Boone doing over here?" And he said, "Well, he's doing a brand new show. They call it Have Gun, Will Travel. It's about a gunfighter who is for hire." And I said, "Wow, that's an interesting concept." So I started drifting down there times when I wasn't needed on our show and watching Richard Boone actually do the first couple of scripts of Have Gun, Will Travel. And it just fascinated me because I was fooling around with the fast draw at that time and had some custom-made Colt 45 rigs and stuff. And I was pretty fast. I was having a pretty good time. And a lot of people in Hollywood were doing that at that particular time because the Westerns took over the channels. With ABC, NBC, and CBS, there were more than 30 Westerns on between 1955 and 1962. Long story short, I asked the casting director who had me on working on Boots and Saddles. I said, "You know, if you ever come up with a script on Have Gun, Will Travel that would have a young whippersnapper like me going up against Paladin in a gunfight, I sure would like to have a shot at it." About 2 weeks later, he came up and said, "What you were talking to me about the young guy going with a gunfight with Paladin," said, "I've got a script that just came in." And he said, "You've got the part." I said, "Well, don't I have to read for it?" He said, "No, you're already doing a series for me. You don't have to read for anything." He said, "Just show up with your gun." So I did, and on the 13th and 14th of March of 1958, we were on location about 40 miles out of Los Angeles at Iverson's famous movie ranch out there, and my wife was expecting our second child. And of course, at that time, we didn't know whether it was going to be a boy or a girl, but I had everybody on alert, so we finished shooting at 9 o'clock at night out there. We had to use all the lights we could get to get the last couple of shots. And then the next morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, I got the word that we were going to the hospital. And so at 7 o'clock in the morning, my daughter Leslie was born. And then my mother-in-law came over and got our number one daughter, who was 3 years older, and took her for the day, because in those days you couldn't come back and see your newborn babies except twice a day and behind glass. And none of this being in the delivery room and, you know, the videographing, the whole thing, none of that.
Right.
So I
was
very, 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 very nervous after she left me alone and took Louisa with her. And I started singing my favorite thing, Ghost Riders in the Sky. But when I was on location working on the film, I noticed a couple of things about Richard Boone, Dream, of course, dressed in all the black outfit, the Man in Black thing, and like just everything that was going, plus the way that our film turned out was really wonderful. And I had the idea that since he always started out in the famous Carlton Hotel in San Francisco as kind of a dressed-up dandy and then would disappear into the heartlands dressed in black in his gunfighter outfit, that Paladin, where do you roam? Obviously far from San Francisco, far from home. That part I had going through my head. So I started doing this thing, and all of a sudden it started to roll. And Belinda, I wrote that whole song in 20 minutes, just as fast as I could get it down. I had a yellow Regal tablet there and wrote it down. I had a little home recorder, but the capstan was bad. It was one of those things that made it wow, you know, so everything was like wow, wow, wow. I thought, I better record this thing since I can't read music. I better record this thing as fast as I could. So I called a friend of mine who had a small recording studio in downtown Hollywood that actually owed me about 15 minutes of studio time. And I said, "Sandy, I need to record one song. It'd take me 5 minutes." He said, "Come on down." So I did, and he made me a couple of those little acetate recordings, and it gave me the master tape, and I took it over to Richard Boone at the studio, who was shooting another episode by that time, and Sam Rolfe, who had created the show and wrote the script that I was in. I said, "Thank you guys for having me on the show. This is my musical thank you card," and I just walked away. Well, over the weekend, without my knowing it, they played that song to the big shots in New York over what they call the hotline, which is just broadcast quality. And Mitch Miller, who was running Columbia Records, was standing there at the same time. And so they called me the following Tuesday and said, we need to see you at 2 o'clock this afternoon at CBS in downtown Hollywood, because we want to use that song for the theme song for the show. And I didn't realize that they did not have a sung theme song. They had a musical little piece at the beginning of the show, and they just repeated that at the end of the show with the instrumental part. But anyway, we'll just cut to the chase here. I went over, and in 20 minutes' time with my agent, we worked out a deal where I had a Columbia record contract with Mitch Miller, and I had a contract as the writer of the song with CBS Television, and the singer of the song with CBS Television. Now, in the meantime, before we got to the recording session with Mitch Miller, Richard Boone suggested that we change the tempo of the song. I had the hoofbeats thing, the Ghost Riders in the Sky thing going for the chorus. He said, why don't we just start at the very beginning and use that beat, that dum 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 dum, that hoofbeat thing at the very beginning, so I think it'd be more exciting. That's a great suggestion. And then Sam Rolfe, who was the writer and creator of the show, said, you got one line in that thing that's just a little bit wordy. He said, you've got it, his fast gun for hire heeds the call of the wind. He said, that's a little wordy and a little long, a little too Shakespearean. He said, let's just do this. His fast gun for hire heeds the calling wind. And I, wow. So, in sheer gratitude for those guys with the suggestion from Richard Boone of the beat of the song and Sam Rolfe changing that one line, I gave those guys a piece of the song, so we became co-writers, and they took it, of course, upon themselves to get me this whole deal. So without Dick Boone and without Sam Rolfe, this never would have happened. Never in the world, because I did not write it as a theme song. I wrote it as a musical thank you card to those guys for having me on the show.
Wow. That's a great story, Johnny. Well, we have to still listen to the song, so let's listen to The Ballad of Paladin.
I've gone, will travel, reach the card of a man. A knight without armor in a savage land. His fast gun for hire heeds the calling wind. A soldier of fortune is the man called Paladin, far, far from home. He travels on to wherever he must. A chest knight of silver is his badge of trust. There are campfire legends that the plainsmen spin. Of the man with the gun, of the man called Paladin. Paladin, Paladin, where do you roam? Paladin, Paladin, far, far from home. Far from home. Far from home.
Brings back a lot of memories, Johnny, because my mom was a huge Richard Boone fan, and we never missed an episode. And so I grew up listening to you singing that song.
Oh, boy. Well, thank you so very much. You know, we just had a wonderful thing happen. We've just completed 4 years of daily reruns on the Encore Western Channel at the first of the year. January 1st was the last run of the show, but it was on 4 years every afternoon. So we had people who were grandparents, who are grandparents now, and great-grandparents, were watching the show with their children and great-grandchildren for another whole audience. So it's been a very, very lucky thing. Since I wrote that song 57 years ago, it has never been off the air someplace in the world for that time. And it's just been a needless to say, a financial annuity. But on that thing, I told my agent the day we signed the contract with CBS, I said, Peter, if this thing will just last 3 or 4 years, it'll do everything in the world I want it to do. Get me on a big hit show and a Columbia record contract, you know, which is the label I definitely wanted to be on. And that whole thing fell into place, never dreaming it would be, you know, more than 5 decades. And it has,
wow.
I had a wonderful thing happen this past January. The latest edition, the first of the year edition of American Cowboy Magazine was running a reader poll, and I didn't know it. And my Ballad of Paladin was voted the number one TV Western theme song of all time. And I would have loved to have been in the top 10, but it was the number one. And I'm just thrilled to death that has happened this many years down the line. And, of course, it's just been the thrill of a lifetime to be able to do this song, as I said, for more than 5 decades.
Wow. Oh, well, it's always a thrill to hear you to do it live. But, boy, listening to that recorded version of it, it was just amazing. I don't think it was a luck thing. I think God had his hand on you with all of this stuff.
I think he's had his hand on me the whole time, you know, from the day I was 5 years old at least, because this seemed to be a destiny type thing, Belinda, and I've loved every second of it. When I retired from the road here a year and a half ago, I was at the Rex Allen Days celebration in Wilcox, Arizona, doing my final show, and I said, I have been the luckiest guy in the world to have had a little boy's dream when I was 5 years old come true, bigger than I ever dreamed as a little guy. You know, it's just been, it's been a fantastic ride.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yes, it has. And you're officially retired, but you're we'll talk about more about that a little bit later. But right now, another big milestone for you and a career skewing path that you took off on was when you hooked up with Johnny Cash. Can you tell us how all that came about?
Well, I was actually working with Gene Autry when I took Johnny Bond's place on the Gene Autry Show in 1956. And Johnny had been playing guitar and featured singer with Gene for 30 years, and he decided he was tired of the road. And Gene heard me sing at a private party when I was singing actually with Roy Rogers and the Sons of the Pioneers. A couple of weeks later, remembered it as Johnny Bond announced that he was leaving the road, and Gene had my actor friend Dick Jones, who actually had sponsored that party and got me to sing on that show, called me up and said, Gene Autry wants to see you tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Be there. I was. Anyway, he put me under contract and took me all over the world with him, as I said, until he retired a couple of years later. But the second show that we worked, Belinda, was the Canadian National Exhibition in Toronto, which is like the World's Fair. Absolutely huge. We were up there for 14 days. And you think Garth Brooks has been a hot item and still is across the world. Gene Autry was the biggest thing in the world. We drew, with the Gene Autry show, 3 million people in 14 days. 2 shows a day.
Wow.
Like Woodstock every afternoon and Woodstock every night. From the center of that big stage in Toronto, we could not see with peripheral vision the end of the crowd. You had to look to the right or look to the left to see the crowd. It was that monstrously big. It was hundreds of thousands of people every day. It was just a great, great time. And while this was going on, the July of 1956, Johnny Cash had come out with his third record, which was I Walk the Line. And he was appearing with Ira and Charlie Louvin, the Louvin brothers, downtown Toronto at a movie theater doing his shows between movies. And he was doing like 4 or 5 shows a day. So he was still going after we finished our second show with Gene Autry at the exhibition grounds out there in Toronto. I would grab a cab and run down there and catch his last show. And, of course, he'd already had the Folsom Prison Blues out, the original Folsom Prison on Sun Records. And the first record we'd never heard out on the West Coast, they did not play Cry, Cry, Cry and Hey Porter, but they started playing Folsom Prison. I just had this vision of myself. To myself, I should say, if you never having seen a picture of him, this guy had to be over 6 feet tall with jet black hair. Of course, I had no facial thing, but I knew he had to be a real manly-looking guy. And the minute I saw him on stage there in Toronto, I said, yes, everything I thought he was going to be. And, of course, he looked and sounded exactly like his records. So I met him after a show there very briefly and told him I was working with Gene Autry and all like that. And he said, I'm thinking about moving out to the West Coast someday. He'll say, I'll look you up. That was kind of that, because that was 1956. Well, cut to the chase there. In 1958, he did move out to the West Coast from Memphis, and he bought Johnny Carson's house. Johnny Carson was moving to New York to do The Tonight Show with Ed McMahon, and Johnny Cash bought Johnny Carson's house. So he was barely ensconced there, and my former best friend in the world, lost him some years ago, but such a great guy, and great fiddle player, great entertainer, Gordon Terry, had worked some dates with Johnny, and he was living on the West Coast, so he said, let's go down to Johnny Cash's office and hang out for a while. And I hadn't seen Johnny, as I said, for 2 years. Went down there, and we started talking and shaking hands. He said, I got a few dates coming up. He said, I'm going to give you a call. And he did. He called me and said, I've got a date in Bakersfield, I got a date in Fresno, and I got a date in Sacramento, California. How would you like to go with me and open the shows for me? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So we did those three shows. They were all sold out way in advance. And then he called me again about a week later, and he said, I've got next month coming up 16 dates out in the Midwest, which, by the way, included Wichita and Kansas City and all those dates from the Dakotas clear down to Texas. He said, how'd you like to do those dates? And I said, absolutely. Well, that was 19 dates that we had worked in with just in a couple of months. But it just kept on going and kept on going. Then he decided that he didn't want to play guitar on his records anymore. He wanted to concentrate on the lyrics. And he liked my guitar player, and he said, why don't you just play rhythm guitar on all my records from now on? So I did for about 6 or 7 years. I played on 70 Columbia record singles with him and 5 albums. And sometimes Luther was having a little problem with some of those songs, I played lead as well. But basically, I played rhythm guitar on all those sessions and did some arrangements. And it was a lot of fun. But by the time the whole thing ended, Belinda, that three-day tour turned out to be 39 years and 11 months. As most of the world knows, that Johnny became ill with a Parkinson's type thing called Scheidt-Rieger syndrome, which turned out to be not the real thing. It was actually autonomic neuropathy, which is a derivation of diabetes that eventually took his life 12 years ago. When he had to stop touring, then I had to stop touring with him. And if we'd have worked one more show 1 month later, it would have been an even 40 years.
Wow. Wow. Boy, what a run. And I was really interested to read that when he was having vocal issues, that you would actually record his songs and then he'd come and overdub his voice later.
That's true, because, you know, they were spending a lot of money with big sessions and so when we recorded in Hollywood especially, there would be, you know, lots of violins and 7 singers instead of 4 and that type of thing. And a couple of my favorite songs that I was just to play guitar on, Johnny's beautiful Irish song, 40 Shades of Green, which has now become like a national anthem in Ireland, was one of the songs. And he wrote a Civil War song, a great song called The Big Battle. And he had a temperature of 103 the night that the session was supposed to go there at Columbia Studios in Hollywood. And Don Law had come out from Nashville, our producer from Nashville, my producer and his, and Marty Robbins and Ray Price. This guy produced all the big records, Johnny Horton, everybody. And he said, all these people are being paid and we've got no Johnny Cash. He said, Johnny, you do the vocals. And he said, we'll bring Cash in when he feels better and he can overdub these things. So I did those things. And they stayed buried in the vaults for 4 decades. And then Richard Weitzer, who has Bear Family Records in Germany, bought everything that Columbia had ever recorded of Johnny Cash, and that included those songs. And he put them out in a big album, a big box set album for me called Heroes and Cowboys, and there were those songs after all those years with my vocals.
Wow. Wow.
You know, so the world got to hear them finally 40 years later. But, yeah, it was a wonderful experience. And Johnny, you know, Johnny was my very best friend in the music business for so many years, and absolutely devastated and broke my heart when he died. He was 71 years old, and, you know, and he went through some terrible health problems there the last 2 years of his life. Then having lost June 4 months before he died, you know, we basically knew he wouldn't last 6 months without her, and he didn't. He lasted 4 months. So all these great memories, Belinda, we're sharing with folks that they've been a giant part of my life for sure.
Oh gosh, you can easily just feel that and just the emotion in your voice and as you talk about him. I mean, what a wonderful privilege to be such a close friend with someone like that. That's amazing. Oh gosh.
Well, so you know, when you're traveling, we were on the road sometimes more than 200 days a year, a lot of one-nighters, and you get to know the people you're on the road with better than you know your own family. It's just that way. There were some years that I was on the road more than 250 days a year, and Joe had to be mom and dad, you know, with our daughters and stuff and take care of everything. I sent the money home, and then I get home when I could, but it was the road. And that's part of it. But Johnny was just this very special, special person in my life and absolutely devastated. I have the easiest way to describe it, I have a hole about the size of a Cadillac hubcap in the middle of my stomach that will never heal up. Over his loss, the fact that I can't pick up the phone and call him and and we talked like we always did, and confided in each other the most personal things and family troubles and the good things and the bad things and the ugly things and everything else were involved in that.
Wow.
A wonderful writer named Robert Hilburn, who was the music critic for the Los Angeles Times for 30 years, and Bob Hilburn spent 3 years writing a book on Johnny Cash that came out last year called Johnny Cash, The Life. And he interviewed me for over 20 hours about my life with Johnny Cash, and most of it's in that book, and it became a big bestseller last year. So if people are interested in finding out what that was all like, that book is still out there, and I think it's even in paperback now.
Wow. Well, I definitely am going to go get me one. So that's I would love to read that. That's awesome. I've been a big Johnny Cash fan my whole life. So
well, he was the most complex man that I ever knew in my life. You know, he's a guy with only a high school education, but he had an IQ of 160, if you can believe that, and never went to college a day in his life. But he had that great mentality, that great ability to write poetry and music. He started writing poetry when he was 10, 11, 12 years old. Just poems like Edna St. Vincent Millay would write. And I got to be one of the few people that ever saw those poems after he became famous. So it was something that he always wanted to do. It was something that built into him. And the great songs that he wrote through the years that people will remember forever. I think Dwight Yoakam said it best when Johnny died 12 years ago. Dwight Yoakam said, 200 years from now, people will be singing Johnny Cash songs. And I think that's absolutely true.
I think it's true, too. Wow. What a wonderful chapter in your life.
Oh, it was my life.
It was your life. I can tell. I can tell. So I would like to know now, I mean, because when I'm, you're a Wichita. So with what little time we have left, we want to do another song and talk to you a little bit more. But can you tell us briefly how that came to be?
Well, Johnny Cash and I, again, and Gordon Terry worked a show in January every year for a young 19, 20-year-old disc jockey named Mike Oatman down in El Paso, Texas, at KHEY, K-Hey Radio, the Mighty 690. And we did those big shows sold out every year. And Mike would book me then back several months later as a guest star with his band for 3 or 4 days because of the records that he was playing of mine on Columbia Records and so forth, and the fact that I had an audience built in because of the Johnny Cash show. And all like that, and I got to know Mike really well personally, never dreaming that he was going to leave El Paso and became a partner in Great Empire Broadcasting in Wichita, which eventually developed into 15 of the biggest country music radio stations in America. And about 10 years before I ever went up there in 1986, about 1976, during the bicentennial, he started making noises like, someday you're going to want to get off the road, and he said, I'll tell you what, you got that great disc jockey ability and that great radio voice and this and that and the other thing. Said, tell you what I'll do. Said, you can pick any one of our 5 markets. Come to work with us and do a radio show 5 days a week and get out and pick and sing on the weekend. Or when Cash needs you, you can go for a week or 10 days, whatever, Waylon, whoever you're going to work with, and come back and tell the folks where you've been and how big the crowds were and all like that, how much fun you had. And it was like the offer I couldn't refuse, but I did refuse it for 10 years, and he kept harping on it. Finally, when I hit the situation where in 1985, I was up there working a show, and he said, I want to play hardball here. He said, I want you to really get off the road and come and do what I told you. So we're going to give you an interest in our radio station thing, stock ownership. We're going to give you a 401K. We're going to give you health insurance. We're going to give you this, that, and the other thing, and a whole bunch of stuff. And it was the famous offer I couldn't refuse, and a lot of money on top of that. So I thought, well, this would be the best of two worlds. I've been on the road for millions of miles now, and I can still go on the road, but I don't have to do it 250, 300 days a year. So it worked out just exactly that way, and I had almost 25 years up there under that circumstance where I could still go out and play the concerts and do the radio show and be home watching my TV set in the evening and eating meals with Joe. Our kids were grown by that time, and so she and I were empty nesters and just having a great life. And then whenever I did concerts, I took her with me every place we could go. Speaking of Johnny Cash, that was one of the neatest things that ever was when she first met Johnny when we first got married in 1966. He walked over and said, welcome to our family, and gave her a kiss on the lips. And she walked over and she said, he's got the softest lips. Well, he did that on the beginning of every tour that we ever worked until he couldn't tour anymore. The very first date of every tour, he'd walk across backstage and grab her by the shoulders and give her a kiss right on the lips. And she invariably said, he's got the softest lips. So that was that kind of a deal. So I had the best of two worlds. And when you came on my radio show there in Wichita, when you were working the dates out through Kansas there, and, of course, we worked together at Silver Dollar City, which was a lot of fun to do those cowboy days over there. It was just the best of two worlds, absolutely, and I stayed there until time to hang it up. I picked my age thing. At age 75, I was going to hang it up, and I did. And we moved back to Arizona. We had lived in Scottsdale for 15 years. Our girls all graduated from Scottsdale High School. And so they were doing their own thing, and we moved back here. My wife, Joel, was born and raised in Mesa, Arizona, where I'm talking from right now. And we've been back here for 5 years and just having a great, great time.
Oh, gosh. Well, I was just at the Prairie Road Chuck Wagon in Wichita, and they miss you. Oh, my gosh, are you missed.
You know, they're so nice up there. I had 10 years of playing two or three times a year out there and almost every New Year's Eve. And with their Silver Screen Cowboys Museum up there, they have kept a Johnny Western exhibit with a lot of my old stuff and one of my guitars. And it's just nice to be remembered like that. You know, it really is.
Yeah. Well, I definitely saw it. So it just that also is another really incredible chapter in your life. My goodness. Well, I'd like to get in another one of your songs here before we have to say goodbye to you. So why don't we listen to Cowpoke? Do you want to say anything about this song?
This is a song that I think really put me in the Western Music Hall of Fame. Again, Stan Jones wrote this song. Originally, another movie song that didn't get in the movie. He had an argument with the producers, which at that time was Howard Hughes at RKO. Robert Mitchum starred in a rodeo movie called The Lusty Men, and Stan wrote this song for that movie, and then they couldn't get together in the movie, so he pulled the song. But when I first heard the song, I said, I've got to record that song. And I got it from Rex Allen Sr. Rex said, you've got to record this song. The blessing of it was, by the time we put it in this album with the Sons of the Pioneers doing this great job with me, Stan Jones gave me the greatest compliment of all time. He said, that is the greatest record of Cowpoke of the 30 or 40 records that have been done on this song that I've ever heard. So Stan died when he was 49 years old, and he's buried in the Cochise Cemetery over there in Douglas, Arizona. And I've always had this wonderful memory of these great songs that he gave me, and thanks to Rex Allen Sr., Cowpoke turned out to be the best of them.
Wow. Well, let's listen to Cowpoke.
Ooh, 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 ooh. I'm lonesome but happy, rich but I'm broke, and the good Lord knows the reason. I'm just a cowpoke. From Cheyenne to Douglas, all the ranges I know, 'cause I drift with the wind, no one cares where I go. Back to beans, but I'll pick up a 10 spot in Prescott, I know, or open some calves in the big rodeo. Well, it's north in the spring if there ain't a big drought, and as soon as it frosts, I'll be heading back south. But I ain't got a worry, 'cause I ain't got time. Living this free life of mine. Ooh, ooh. Some evening in the springtime, a filly I'll find. But I'll never be branded can never be broke. I'm a carefree range riding, drifting cowpoke.
He's a drifting cowpoke.
Agree with Mr. Jones, Johnny. That's the best version I've heard of that song. Wow.
Well, thank you, Belinda. That's very kind of you. I've got one little story I can tell you about that song. The recording session with the Sons of the Pioneers, in the time of the Pioneers, of course, was Dale Warren, who became the leader of the Sons of the Pioneers for 57 years. And you know all about Dale. He passed away a few years ago. It's been inducted into the Western Music Hall of Fame, the WMA, and, of course, the great Lloyd Perryman, who for more than 40 years did all the great arrangements for the Pioneers, and Tommy Doss, who sounded so much like Bob Nolan, of course, is also a member of the Western Music Hall of Fame. But the bass singer, since Hugh Farr was no longer a part of the Sons of the Pioneers when we recorded that, the bass singer is the great Thurl Ravenscroft. And everybody that's listening to you and I right now has heard Thurl Ravenscroft for many, many years and still do, even though he passed away a few years ago. He was the voice of Tony the Tiger on the Kellogg's commercials for all those years with that deep bass voice and saying, "That's great." That was Thurl Ravenscroft. So he had this magnificent bass voice and added that extra plus with the Sons of the Pioneers to my recordings. And I was so grateful that he could be there.
That's a great story. Oh, my gosh. Well, we've just had so much fun talking with you, Johnny. And I know you're officially retired, but I'm hoping that that doesn't mean you're not going to pop up every now and then and share your wonderful talent with us still, because we just all love you so much. And I know you're at the WMA convention every year in Albuquerque, and we're so grateful that you're there for sure.
Well, you know, it's been a joy. I'm still the chairman of the Hall of Fame committee for the WMA, and got five wonderful guys on the committee that work very hard to get the people who deserve to be in the Hall of Fame in that Hall of Fame forever.
Yes.
You know, I've got
I got
to tell all of Belinda's listeners out here that you're listening to the most awarded female Western singer in history. She has more awards in categories than any other cowgirl singer or Western female singer in history, and that goes back, including Dale Evans, or all the others that have ever been in the Hall of Fame previous. So I've got a good hunch that up the line we're going to see Belinda Gale in the Western Music Hall of Fame.
Oh, Johnny.
And deservedly so, may I say. And by the way, it's so great to have you and Bob living in Arizona, just beautiful area in Prescott with your horse ranch up there. We're about 85 miles apart, but we have to see each other occasionally on the road or on the radio.
Absolutely. And I have to just send another shout out for you, Johnny. I'm so excited. Today, this afternoon, you're going to be inducted into the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame. And we are so proud for you to add yet another Hall of Fame induction and onto your long list. And
this is a great honor. I'm thrilled to death that, you know, they've got some wonderful people in that Hall of Fame already. And, of course, Waylon Jennings and Jesse Coulter, Dwayne Eddy. We've got Rex Allen Sr. and Rex Allen Jr. And then, of course, some wonderful rock and rollers, people who have a great association with our state of Arizona. Alice Cooper is in the Hall of Fame. Linda Ronstadt is in the Arizona Hall of Fame. And Bret Michaels, Poison fame, is in the Hall of Fame. So in all fields of music, it's a tremendous, tremendous thing. Of course, not leaving out Marty Robbins, who is in the Hall of Fame also. So great to be able to join these wonderful people forever and ever as of this afternoon.
Oh, gosh. Well, we're so proud of you and so proud for you, Johnny.
Thank you so much. Tell
all of our listeners, I know if they have not been familiar with you before, I know they are so going to want to get their hands on some of your music and be able to enjoy that incredible voice of yours. And so can you tell us where that they can pick up your music?
Yes, I've got three CDs available through my website, which is in all lowercase letters, just all lowercase letters with no spaces. It's Johnny Western Touring, johnnywesterntouring.com. It's just that easy. And it'll come up there with a little shot and so forth and give you the titles and all that kind of stuff. And it's just right there. But
I'm sure you'll be selling some music. I would hope. So I just love it, and just thank you again for being on the show, Johnny. And please give your beautiful wife, Jo, what a treasure she is. We didn't talk a lot about her. We'll just have to have you back on so we can talk more about Jo and your life. You know, now that you're retired, but just please give her a big hug for me, and we hope to see you all soon. And thank you again for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much. And you give Robert our very, very best. A great guy that you were married to. Robert Lorbeer is a kind of extended family of ours by way of Nola Folston there in Wichita, Kansas. That's another whole long story. But we love Bob and we love you, and we're going to get up and see you in Prescott one of these days. Well, what a great joy to be on your radio show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my joy, my pleasure, absolutely. And we're going to close out this segment with Johnny by listening to a wonderful song that you've done, Last Roundup. Now, did you want to say anything about that before we go to the song?
Billy Hill, who was a Tin Pan Alley songwriter in New York in the Brill Building, actually wrote this great Western song. But this is the closest to a great religious song that I've ever had a chance to record. You know, when you're on a big record label like Columbia Records, they want to get your records out there to the most number of people. And not known for being a gospel singer, we came up with this song and said, yes, let's do this. It'll be a great addition to the Have Gun Will Travel album. And, of course, with the voices of the Sons of the Pioneers and everything, this is as good as it gets with a great Western song that has that great, wonderful, godly overtone to it. And this song will be around forever. It really will. And thank you so much for playing it on your show.
I'm happy to do it. And thank you again for being with us. And we're going to close out Johnny's segment with Last Roundup.
I'm heading for the last roundup. Gonna saddle old Paint for the last time and ride. So long, old pal, it's time your tears were dry. I'm heading for the last roundup. Get along, little dogie, get along, get along. Get along, little dogie, get along.
they'll be there.
An honor to have Johnny on the show today. And you know, as I was thinking about his life and meditating and asking the Lord which scripture to share with y'all today, two things came to mind. First, what a long and prolific career Johnny has had. You know, even in his 80s, he's still made appearances, and he truly has soared his entire life. And then the idea of spring and renewal came to mind. And no matter where we are in life, we can always count on the Lord to renew us when we wait upon him, which then led me to the scripture in Isaiah that I just love. And the Amplified Version is one of my favorites. It's Isaiah 40:31, and it reads, "But those who wait upon the Lord, who expect and look for and hope in him, shall change and renew their strength and power. They shall lift their wings and mount up close to God as eagles mount up to the sun. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not become faint or tired." Well, I don't know about you, but for me, waiting upon the Lord is one of the most challenging things he asked me to do. I'm kind of a get-or-done gal and want to jump in and do things. But goodness, look what the Lord promises us when we are willing to wait upon him. We receive renewed strength and power. We will soar like eagles, and we will run and not be weary, and walk and not become faint. So as we enjoy spring, the epitome of renewal, I would encourage you to seek the Lord and wait upon him to lead and guide your steps, and ultimately to soar in the glory of our precious Lord. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and I'd like to send out another huge thank you to Johnny Western for being on the show with us today, and of course to Gary Holt for the amazing job he always does producing this show. Remember that there are several wonderful shows on Equestrian Legacy Radio, and all of them are archived, so you can go back and listen to any of them whenever it is convenient for you. We even have a nifty little app that you can download to your mobile devices to take us on the go with you. Also, we really appreciate you spreading the word by telling your friends about us. And you could even like us on Facebook at Equestrian Legacy Radio. So until next week, we wish you blessed trails.
Traveling down life's rugged road, stumbling neath a heavy load, I was headed for a fate of ill design. Many folks for me prayed, many pleas for me were made. I should have read that detour sign. Detour, there's a muddy road ahead. Detour, paid no mind to what it said. Detour, mine, I should have read that detour sign. When I got stuck in the mud, all my hopes fell with a thud, but the blame for being stuck there was all mine. For I'd hear time and again, Christ could lift my soul from sin. I should have read that detour sign. Detour, there's a muddy road ahead. Detour, paid no mind to what it said. Detour, all those bitter things are mine. I should have read that detour sign. I could no more go on. I did to the Lord my life and soul return.